Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're not just looking at some far-off future threat. We are basically performing an urgent executive stress test on a danger that's happening right now.
Right now, that's the key.
Our mission is to cut through all the quantum hype and really deliver a sharp, fact-based summary on the Harvest Now, Decrypt Later threat. You'll hear it called HNDL. It is without a doubt the single most critical temporal risk facing global cybersecurity.
It really is.
So we've synthesized sources from, you know, the big ones, NIST, IBM, CISA, the SEC, and major technical roadmaps to give you the executive briefing you need on these converging timelines and, more importantly, the immediate operational responses that are required.
And that phrase you use, temporal risk, is so important. What we're really exploring here is this fundamental mismatch that has, well, it's completely flipped the traditional cybersecurity model on its head.
How so?
For decades, the rule was simple. If you encrypted data correctly, it was safe. Safe for the entire life of that data. HNDL means the guarantee is just gone.
The guarantee's broken.
It's gone. The underlying math is broken. Not by a quantum computer that's sitting in a lab today, but by the absolute certainty that one will exist and soon.
Okay, let's unpack that core threat then, the data lifespan risk. We hear HNDL, sometimes SNDL, store now, decrypt later. But the concept is always the same.
Always the same.
A persistent strategic adversary is doing mass archival collection today. They're targeting data encrypted with our current standards, public key algorithms like RSA and ECC, with the full expectation they can unlock it all later.
It's the ultimate patient attack. They aren't trying to break the encryption now because, as we'll get into, that would take, well, a conventional computer would need 300 trillion years.
Right. Impractical.
Completely. So instead, they are simply stockpiling massive, and I mean massive, caches of stolen, encrypted communications, intellectual property, sensitive PII, everything.
And that's why it's a present-day risk.
Yeah.
Even though the tool to decrypt it, the cryptographically relevant quantum computer, or CRQC, is still being built.
Precisely. The vulnerability exists because of this huge time mismatch. On one hand, you have the data's required secrecy lifetime, which for a lot of strategic assets can be decades.
Decades, yep.
And on the other, you have the effective cryptographic lifetime of the current protocols protecting it, and that is expiring much, much sooner.
So, simply put, the lifespan of the data outlasts the lifespan of the lock. If I have a strategic corporate blueprint, let's say, that has to stay confidential for 25 years.
A classic example.
And the encryption protecting it is only really effective for another 10 years, then that 25-year blueprint is already compromised. It's sitting in an adversary's archive right now waiting.
That is precisely the mechanism of HNDL exposure. That's it, in a nutshell. The adversary doesn't need to hurry. They're operating on this premise of, you know, strategic patience. They're making long-term bets.
On what kind of data?
Think about the biggest targets. Strategic corporate blueprints, like you said, state secrets, private health records, R&D pipelines. The value of this information often increases over time, or at least it holds its criticality.
So if an attacker steals 10 years of proprietary drug trial data today,
they'll just sit on it. And that data will be immensely valuable the day the CRQC arrives, maybe 5-10 years from now. They are building a massive historical archive today, betting on a guaranteed retroactive key discovery in the future.
The way the sources describe this HNDL adversary, it sounds less like a typical hacker group and more like a well-funded state-level operation.
Oh, that's a crucial distinction. It has to be. A traditional cyber attack is often focused on immediate access, right? Disruption, or maybe quick financial gain. The HNDL adversary is operating at a geopolitical scale.
Just the resources required.
Think about it. You'd need massive, almost unimaginable storage capacity to hold exabytes of intercepted ciphertext. You need immense resources for persistent network interception, and you need the long-term political will to fund the quantum computing effort itself.
It changes the risk profile completely.
Completely. We're moving from defending against a smash and grab to defending against the patient, strategic harvesting operation of a nation state.
And the fact that we can't even detect the compromise today. I mean, the data looks perfectly fine. It's encrypted. That just lends this eerie silence to the whole threat landscape. It's a silent, invisible theft.
It is. The integrity of the system appears sound right now, which is exactly why the perception of risk is often dangerously low. The integrity holds right up until Q day.
Q day, the moment the CRQC is operational.
Right. But by then, the compromise is already decades deep. The challenge for today's CSOs isn't preventing the decryption in the future. It's preventing the harvesting now and ensuring data collected today cannot be decrypted 10 or 20 years from now.
Well, that sets a terrifying stage, and it leads us directly into part one, the accelerated quantum timeline. Because the window we have to prepare is directly tied to how fast this quantum progress is happening.
It's a race.
When this threat was first being discussed, the estimates for a fault-tolerant quantum computer, an FTQC, were way out there, like 2035 to 2040.
I remember those days. Seemed like science fiction.
It did. What do the sources now tell us about that timeline?
The key takeaway, and this is probably the most important point, is that the goalposts have moved significantly closer. Those 2035, 2040 estimates, they're now generally regarded as outdated.
By who?
Especially by the industry leaders who are actually engineering these systems. The more aggressive recent projections place the arrival of a CRQC, that is, a machine that can execute Shor's algorithm efficiently enough to break our standard RSA 2048 keys as early as 2028, 2030.
2028, that's a huge shift. We've cut a decade or more off the preparation time. What's driving this acceleration? Is it just more money being thrown at the problem, or are there real scientific breakthroughs?
It's a combination, but the scientific breakthroughs are definitely key. The primary hurdle in quantum computing has always been noise and decoherence.
Errors, basically.
Exactly. Errors introduced by the environment. The acceleration we're seeing stems from rapid and, more importantly, verifiable progress in quantum error correction, or QEC.
And QEC is the secret sauce.
It's the difference between a noisy, research-grade quantum computer and a reliable, fault-tolerant system you can actually use to solve a problem. The sources show that increased qubit coherence times, plus the enormous influx of public and private investment, have let the field move from just pure theory to a very competitive, high-stakes engineering race. We're building the machines now, not just proving they're possible.
Let's get quantitative then. Let's look at the actual roadmaps. IBM is probably the most vocal about their progress. What concrete milestones are they setting that back up, this aggressive 2028, 2030 projection?
Okay, so IBM's published roadmaps are essential to understanding this. In 2023, they hit a big scale milestone. They demonstrated the 1121 qubit Condor processor, but scale isn't everything.
It's the quality of the qubits that matters.
It's the logical qubits that matter. Their roadmap shows a clear path to systems with over 4,000 physical qubits, but more importantly, they project fault-tolerant systems, ones that can execute Shor's algorithm against RSA 2048 within the current decade.
Okay, so when we talk about a fault-tolerant system, what's the crucial number of logical qubits we need to be watching for?
For risk management purposes, the figure IBM has publicly committed to is delivering a 200 logical qubit fault-tolerant quantum computer by 2029.
2029.
And that is a major inflection point. A logical qubit is an error-corrected, robust qubit that's built from many noisy physical ones. The jump from a theoretical possibility to a confirmed roadmap delivery of 200 logical qubits by 2029 is what forces immediate action from organizations today. This isn't just research anymore. It's a project deadline being set by one of the world's biggest tech firms.
So 2029 is IBM's public marker.
Yeah.
What about their competitors? I'm thinking of IonQ. They use a different technology.
Right, trapped ion technology. So IonQ, using that different physical architecture, has published roadmaps suggesting that cryptographically relevant systems could arrive even earlier. They're citing 2028.
So it's a race.
It's a race. And it's important to see these timelines not as just single predictions, but as a convergence of aggressive targets across different technologies. That competitive pressure just reinforces the urgency.
And on the error correction side, you mentioned Google's progress. What was the milestone they hit in late 2024? Why was that so critical?
Google's achievement with their Willow chip in December 2024 was huge because it demonstrated below-threshold quantum error correction.
Okay, what does that mean in simple terms?
In simple terms, it means they proved that adding more physical qubits to build a logical qubit actually reduced the error rate instead of increasing it.
Which was a major worry.
A huge worry. It confirmed that the fundamental physics of building reliable, large-scale, fault-tolerant machines actually holds up. It removed a major, almost existential scientific doubt about whether building a CRQC was even possible. We are so far past the if now. We are firmly in the when.
Let's use that analogy from the sources, the one that really captures the scale of this. The time difference between breaking RSA 2048 encryption classically versus with a quantum computer.
This is the data point that should make every single CISO listening immediately go and allocate budget. A conventional classical supercomputer needs an estimated 300 trillion years to brute force an RSA 2048 key.
Essentially impossible. A guarantee of security.
A static guarantee, yes. Now look at the quantum projection. The sources cite analysis showing that a large enough, say, 4,099 qubit quantum computer would need only 10 seconds to crack the exact same key.
10 seconds.
Yeah.
Versus 300 trillion years. That's not a faster computer. That's an entirely different mathematical reality.
It is.
And because a typical network TLS handshake happens in milliseconds, that cracking time becomes effectively instantaneous from an operational perspective.
It's immediate. The moment Q-Day arrives, encryption integrity fails almost instantly upon request. And this shifts our focus from just hardware development to understanding what's called the adversarial horizon, or hard dollars.
Okay, walk us through how do we quantify the risk exposure we have right now in years using a conservative technical baseline?
So ADRS is the adversarial decryption horizon. It's the time until a CRQC can break the data we're encrypting today. To get a baseline, we can turn to the resource analysis done by researchers like Gidney and Icaro. They modeled the exact resources needed to break RSA 2048.
And what did they find?
Based on current conservative estimates of how fast these machines are improving, their analysis places Aller at 19 years.
19 years. That is a concrete number. So that means any piece of information we encrypt today that needs to stay secret for even 20 years
is mathematically guaranteed to be vulnerable to a retrospective compromise.
It makes the vulnerability temporal and quantifiable.
And that 19-year conservative baseline serves as the absolute minimum deadline for migration planning. If your data lifespan, we call it lover dollars alls, is longer than 19 years, you are actively accumulating massive HNDL risk right now. And for many high-value sectors, 19 years is a very, very short time.
That quantifiable risk leads us straight into part two, defining the scope of this risk and liability. It's about matching the data's required secrecy lifetime, level dollars, against that adversarial horizon, Herr-Mahler. It's basically an exercise in temporal risk management.
That's a great way to put it.
So which sectors are failing this stress test the most dramatically? The ones whose data is designed to outlive our current crypto?
The sources are very clear on this. The sectors with critical exposure are the ones handling information that requires decades of confidentiality. Specifically, you're looking at financial institutions, healthcare providers, and government defense contractors.
Right.
They all manage assets that have to remain secret for longer than health of dollars.
Let's start with financial institutions. Why is the risk systemic here? It's got to be more than just typical customer data.
Oh, it's far beyond that. The risk is systemic because the core trust mechanisms of the entire global financial system, digital signatures, secure transactions, asset custody, they all rely heavily on vulnerable public key cryptography.
So what are they holding?
Financial institutions have long-term contracts, proprietary investment strategies, think high-frequency trading algorithms, and crucially, digital asset custody. The security of modern cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and Ethereum relies on something called the Elliptic Curve Digital Signature Algorithm, or ECDSA.
And that's vulnerable.
It's fundamentally vulnerable to Shor's algorithm.
So if a CRQC can break ECDSA, what does that mean for someone holding Bitcoin?
It's bad. It means that if an attacker intercepts the public key used for a transaction, and a lot of public keys are recycled or exposed during use, they could use a CRQC to instantly derive the private key.
And drain the wallet?
Instantly. Drain the wallet associated with that key. This is why the SEC and global bodies like the GFMA are explicitly calling quantum risk a systemic risk. A cryptographic failure across thousands of interconnected banks and exchanges could lead to catastrophic, unrecoverable investor losses and just a massive erosion of market confidence in digital transactions altogether.
So the regulatory response has to be synchronized, comprehensive, to avoid that kind of systemic collapse.
Absolutely. The financial sector is already developing frameworks for this, like the Post-Quantum Financial Infrastructure Framework, or PQF. They know that a failure to migrate could bankrupt institutions based on retrospective liability alone.
Okay, let's move to healthcare. You mentioned the uniquely permanent nature of that data. What's the specific long-term liability there?
Healthcare data is the definition of long-lived. Medical records, research data sets, and especially genomic data. It all often requires confidentiality for 30 years or more, sometimes indefinitely.
You can't change your genes.
A patient cannot change their genetic code. The sources consistently highlight genomic data as the highest value target for HNDL. If that's stolen today and decrypted tomorrow, the privacy loss is permanent and it's irreversible.
What are the real-world liabilities that would come from decrypted genomic data years after the fact?
The liabilities are immense. They have a very long tail. First, you've got genetic discrimination. Insurers, employers, they could use this decrypted data against individuals decades later.
That's terrifying.
And second, perhaps more alarmingly, the data could enable highly targeted biothreats or manipulation of public health strategies based on specific vulnerabilities in a population revealed by this decrypted research.
And the financial cost.
Well, the average cost of a single healthcare data breach was already near $10 million in 2025. But HNDL introduces these massive, unpredictable, long-tail liabilities where an institution could be sued for a breach that happened decades after the initial data theft when the quantum key finally unlocked the stolen archives.
So a hospital chief has to protect data today from a lawsuit that might not even be filed until 2045. That forces a complete recalculation of risk.
It has to. And then finally, you have government and defense contractors. They have the longest data life cycles of all. Classified archives, intelligence records, defense system specs, often 30-year or indefinite retention requirements. Their temporal exposure is critical, which is why the government mandates are so aggressive.
The sources give us a formal model for this, the temporal vulnerability model, which categorizes exposure based on that data confidentiality lifetime, hella dollars.
Mm-hmm.
This seems essential for any executive trying to prioritize.
Yeah.
Can you break down those three classification tiers?
Yeah, this model directly translates data classification into migration urgency. So first, you have medium exposure. That's for data where LOL dollars is between 1 and 7 years.
What's in that category?
Think short-term corporate IP, certain cloud archives, standard operational data. The lifetime exceeds your immediate needs, but it's still within an optimistic migration timeline. These sectors need to be proactive about post-quantum cryptography, PQC adoption. The HNDL risk is manageable if you start now.
Okay, next tier.
High exposure. This is where LOL dollars is between 7 and 30 years. This is the danger zone. It covers health records, critical satellite communications, long-term legal contracts, most sensitive corporate R&D. Since the lifetime here often significantly exceeds that conservative 19-year decryption horizon, these sectors face substantial, near-certain HNDL risk. They need urgent, funded migration planning starting immediately. If you have assets in this category, you are already accruing compromise.
Yeah, last one.
Critical exposure. This is the highest risk. LOL dollars is over 30 years or it's indefinite. This is where you find state intelligence archives, public blockchains that are meant to be immutable, long-term insurance policy records. The data lifetime here far exceeds any realistic quantum decryption horizon. These assets face inevitable retrospective compromise without immediate dedicated protection.
The implication for that critical exposure group is profound. If you're a life insurance company with policyholder data from 150 years ago, or a government agency with indefinite intelligence archives, you're not planning for a future attack. You're addressing a past theft that will inevitably materialize.
Exactly. And that is why the conversation has pivoted from, is quantum coming, to what is our organization's residual exposure window? If you're protecting data with a 40-year lifespan, your current exposure window is 40 minus 19. That's 21 years of harvested secrets. That is the figure executives need to confront. And that harsh reality is what's now driving these government mandates.
That brings us sharply into part three. Government mandates and regulatory urgency. Since the risk is quantified and the timeline is accelerated, government bodies are no longer just, you know, advising, they're demanding migration. Let's start with the U.S. federal effort. What firm deadline did National Security Memorandum 10, NSM 10, establish, and what's the cost of compliance?
NSM 10 is really the policy bedrock for the U.S. federal transition. It establishes a hard deadline of 2035 for the complete migration of all federal systems to PQC.
And that's not a suggestion.
Not at all. It is a directive. It's aimed at securing the entire federal information architecture.
The scale of that effort, just for the federal government, must be staggering. What are the OMB's projections for the financial cost?
The sheer cost really illustrates how complex this cryptographic inventory problem is. The Office of Management and Budget, the OMB, projected that the total government-wide cost for migrating just the prioritized systems to PQC between 2025 and 2035 will be approximately $7.1 billion.
So $2024 dollars.
In 2024 dollars, yes.
$7.1 billion. That's a number that immediately catches the attention of any CFO or Appropriations Committee. What does that money fundamentally cover?
It covers everything from discovery and inventory, just figuring out where all the crypto is being used to, the replacement of specific hardware, A huge chunk of that budget is for replacing hardware security modules, or HSMs.
The physical devices that protect the keys.
Exactly. The physical devices that generate and protect cryptographic keys. You can't just patch an HSM. You often have to replace the entire physical unit across thousands of locations. It also funds massive software development, creating crypto agile applications, training for cryptographic engineers, and all the extensive testing required to ensure things don't break during the hybrid transition phase.
So the complexity and cost of migrating the U.S. government sets a pretty clear benchmark for large, critical private sector enterprises. What concrete guidance has CISA and NIST given to private industry, given this multi-year implementation window?
The guidance is unanimous. Start now. CISA, the NSA, and NIST issued joint guidance back in August 2023, specifically warning that large enterprises typically require anywhere from 5 to 15 years for a complete cryptographic migration.
So do the math.
If you do the math with a 2028-2030 CRQC timeline, that means many migrations must be in their final stages by the end of this decade. Waiting for absolute certainty about Q-Day means accepting that your infrastructure will be vulnerable during the entire migration period.
And the foundation for starting now is the finalized standards from NIST. What are those three PQC algorithms we need to be building around?
The transition from a competition to finalized standards was a massive milestone. That happened in August 2024. These are the algorithms that will define PQC from now on.
Okay, what are they?
First, there's FIX 203, which is MLKM. That's a module lattice-based key encapsulation mechanism, and it's for key exchange. It's the primary replacement for RSA and ECDH.
Got it.
Second is FIPS 204, or MLDSA. That's the module lattice-based digital signature algorithm. It's designed to replace ECDSA and DSA for digital signatures. And third, you have FIPS 205, or SLH-GSA. It's a stateless, hash-based digital signature scheme. Think of it as a conservative secondary fallback.
So the finalization of FIPS 203-204 means the technical uncertainty is largely gone. Enterprises don't have an excuse to defer anymore by saying they're waiting for a winner to be chosen.
Precisely. The blueprints have been delivered. The engineering work can begin. But the U.S. isn't the only driver here. The European Union is operating on an even more aggressive schedule for its critical infrastructure.
Really? How does the EU timeline compare, and what regulatory mechanisms are they using to enforce PQC?
The EU is using existing and new regulations, things like the Digital Operational Resilience Act, DORA, and the NIS2 directives, to mandate cryptographic resilience. And their roadmap, which is supported by a joint statement from 18 member states, is incredibly tight for high-risk systems.
How tight?
By the end of 2026, all EU member states must start their PQC transition. That includes national strategies and full cryptographic inventories across critical sectors. And then the hard deadline for high-risk systems, that's critical infrastructure, utilities, telecom, finance, government, is to be secured with PQC as soon as possible, no later than 2030.
2030, wow. That is far more aggressive than the 2035 NSM10 goal in the U.S. Why the tighter timeline in the EU?
It's tied directly to financial stability and critical infrastructure protection, which is what DORA and NIS2 govern. DORA requires financial entities to test their operational resilience against emerging threats. The EU views the quantum threat not just as a future security risk, but as a current material weakness in the financial supply chain that has to be remediated immediately to maintain market stability.
So if your cryptographic resilience fails, you are non-compliant under DORA.
You're non-compliant. This regulatory convergence DORA in finance, NIS2 in infrastructure, means PQC migration isn't a standalone project. It's a mandatory compliance update across multiple highly regulated industries.
It's just the cost of doing business.
It is now, and this urgency is global. Canada is targeting migration of its high-priority systems by 2031, and the UK has plans for full discovery by 2028 and full migration by 2035.
You touched on global coordination earlier, mentioning things like SWIFT and payment card networks. This introduces a huge synchronization requirement.
Wow.
Why does coordinating across multiple independent institutions extend the timeline so much?
It's a massive logistical challenge. Imagine a single financial transaction that travels through 5 different countries.
Okay.
It involves 7 different cryptographic endpoints, from card readers to central payment processors. Every single one of those endpoints has to support the new PQC or hybrid PQC algorithm at the same time for the chain of trust to hold.
And if one doesn't?
If one legacy system in a remote country, one single financial institution can't support the new standard, the entire network is forced to keep using the vulnerable classical algorithm, or risk-breaking interoperability.
So global migration isn't limited by the fastest institution, it's limited by the slowest one.
Exactly.
Which means these large interdependent networks have to start migrating now just to coordinate the multi-year logistical nightmare of upgrading thousands of independent partners.
The logistical complexity completely dominates the technical complexity. The window to achieve a synchronized global PQC rollout is likely much longer than the time until the CRQC arrives. And that creates this permanent pressure to maintain hybrid operation until the very last major node finally makes the switch.
That global context, coupled with these tight deadlines, brings us right to the most practical segment, part four, the actionable roadmap for CISOs and CTOs. Given the severe time compression, I mean, CRQC is potentially arriving in 2028 or 2030, and the 12 to 15 years it takes a large enterprise to migrate, we're looking at an undeniable risk deficit.
We have to be brutally honest about this deficit. We are facing a critical 3 to 5 year risk deficit, where huge parts of our infrastructure will remain vulnerable during that migration window.
And the sources are clear on this.
They're definitive. The strategy of waiting for certainty about Q-Day is already a catastrophic failure. If you haven't started your cryptographic inventory today, you have implicitly accepted HNDL compromise for your long-lived assets.
So let's jump into phase one, foundation and discovery. What are the first concrete steps organizations must take, and why is just doing an inventory so time-consuming?
Step one is the comprehensive cryptographic asset inventory. This is by far the hardest part for large decentralized organizations. You need to map every single place encryption is used.
Every single one.
Applications, internal APIs, cloud services, mobile devices, hardware, and most critically, third-party integrations and your supply chain dependencies.
Why does this take years? Why can't we just run a quick scan and find it all?
Because cryptography is often deeply embedded and totally invisible. It's not just your external TLS certificates, it's internal message queues, custom protocols and legacy systems, hard-coded libraries in 20-year-old operational technology.
Oh, OT systems.
And obscure uses of digital signatures for non-repudiation in databases. For a Fortune 500 company, this discovery alone might take 2 to 3 years just to locate the full cryptographic estate. You need specialized tools and often manual auditing of source code.
Okay, so once that massive inventory is complete, step two is prioritization.
I see.
And that's where the data lifespan risk model we talked about becomes essential.
Absolutely. Risk-based prioritization is key. You have to use data sensitivity and confidentiality lifetime dollars to determine the migration order. First, you identify and protect the critical exposure data.
The 30-plus year assets.
Right. The records that have to stay confidential for 30-plus years, like long-term IP, proprietary formulas, or health data, those get the fastest, most urgent migration efforts, sometimes requiring immediate re-encryption using hybrid methods. Everything else follows in priority order down to the medium exposure data.
Let's put a financial argument to this urgency. What's the quantitative cost of delay?
The cost of delay analysis is striking. The costs increase exponentially. An organization that begins an early implementation in 2025 is looking at an investment of maybe $10 to $20 million for the initial discovery and pilot migration.
Which is a lot.
But if they wait and are forced into an emergency response scenario migrating after Q-Day is confirmed, the estimated losses spiral into the range of $500 million to over $1 billion.
Wow.
Due to litigation, loss of IP, regulatory fines, business interruption, the math clearly supports the immediate investment.
Okay, so phase two, technical implementation. This is where the rubber meets the road.
Yeah.
Given the uncertainty of the timeline, why is hybrid cryptography the non-negotiable first technical step?
Hybrid cryptography is the crucial defense-in-depth strategy. It's a mechanism that protects against current uncertainty. It means implementing new schemes that combine a classical algorithm, like RSA or ECC, with a PQC algorithm like MLChem in a single protocol exchange.
How does that protect us?
It creates a safe fail mechanism. If, hypothetically, a flaw is discovered in the new PQC algorithm during the transition.
Which could happen.
It could. The classical algorithm is still there, providing security against non-quantum attacks. Conversely, if the CRQC arrives before the migration is complete, the PQC layer is already protecting the data from the quantum adversary. Both cryptographic locks have to be broken to compromise the key.
And the big players are already on board.
This approach is validated by the major cloud providers, AWS, Google, Microsoft. They've all implemented hybrid TLS support, making it accessible right now.
Now we have to talk about the friction. Shifting to PQC standards introduces this huge technical challenge you hear called the bandwidth tax. This isn't just a software patch. This fundamentally changes network traffic profiles.
It creates major operational impacts if you ignore it, and this is where the budget shock often hits. The new PQC algorithms, especially the lattice-based ones like ML-Chem, are very secure, but they require significantly larger key and signature sizes.
How much larger are we talking about, specific?
For Key Exchange, an ML-Chem public key is about 30 to 40 times larger than a classical ECDH public key. We're going from a key size of around 32 bytes to over 1,000 bytes.
And signatures?
The digital signatures are even more dramatic. MLDSA signatures are about 50 times larger, around 3,300 bytes compared to 64 bytes for a standard ECDSA signature.
A 50x increase in signature size on every single authenticated transaction. I can hear network engineers everywhere groaning. What does that do to the network transport layer?
It immediately introduces problems with your MTU, your maximum transmission unit. Larger TLS handshakes and massive signatures mean network packets fragment across multiple packets much more often.
Which means latency.
It increases reassembly overhead and network latency. And critically, a lot of legacy enterprise firewalls, intrusion detection systems, and other middle boxes, they have fixed buffer sizes. When they get fragmented packets or large keys that exceed their buffer limits, they often just interpret it as a malformed packet or a denial of service attack and drop it.
So the very security infrastructure we built to protect the network now actively breaks the PQC connections.
Exactly. The new cryptography breaks the old network hardware. And remediation isn't just a software patch. It might require expensive hardware replacement or a fundamental re-architecture of your network transport layer. It's a massive project management headache.
And the other side of this is the serious storage impact, especially for security teams who need to retain transaction logs for compliance and non-repudiation.
That's the SIEM capacity challenge. Your security information and event management systems and audit trails have to retain these digital signatures.
Right.
If every API transaction logs a 3,300-byte MLDSA signature instead of a 64-byte one,
your storage needs just exploded.
Your log storage requirements and the required processing and indexing capacity of your SIEM infrastructure can increase by a factor of 50. Organizations have to plan and budget now to expand SIEM storage and compute, or they're going to face compliance failure.
Moving into phase three, what's the long-term vision beyond just reacting to these immediate technical hurdles?
Yeah.
The goal has to be resilience.
The goal is crypto agility. That's the cornerstone of phase three. Crypto agility means designing your system so that cryptographic algorithms can be rapidly switched out, updated, or replaced without requiring a huge, costly system redesign.
How do you architect for that?
It requires abstracting the cryptography away from the core application logic. Developers have to use abstract APIs, ensure parameter flexibility, integrate robust protocol negotiation. Crypto agility turns cryptography from a static, hard-coded guarantee into a dynamic assurance process.
For those organizations with critical, decades-old legacy data, the life insurance companies, the government archives, who can't afford a full system replacement, what's the strategy?
You can't replace a 30-year-old mainframe. It's not feasible. The recommended cost-effective approach is to use quantum-safe wrappers and hybrid data re-encryption layers.
So you build a fence around it.
You encapsulate it. Instead of replacing the legacy system, all data entering or leaving it is immediately re-encrypted using a PQC hybrid scheme. This creates a secure, quantum-safe communication environment around the vulnerable core. Case studies show this can save you 60% compared to a complete rip-and-replace strategy.
Finally, let's address two critical bottlenecks. One technical, one personnel. First, the expertise required.
The personnel challenge is maybe the biggest constraint on the timeline. Skilled PQC and cryptographic engineering expertise is incredibly scarce. The global community of crypto engineers is small, specialized, and currently completely overburdened with this transition.
So you can't just hire your way out of it?
No. Training cross-disciplinary teams, developers, network engineers, security architects is essential, but that training pipeline takes years. For large enterprises, this shortage could easily extend migration timelines by several years.
And second, let's clarify the status of symmetric cryptography. We've mostly focused on breaking asymmetric crypto like RSA and ECC with Shor's algorithm. What about symmetric keys like AES?
Right. So symmetric cryptography is targeted by a different quantum algorithm, Grover's algorithm. Grover's offers a quadratic speedup, which means it doesn't break the key outright, but it effectively halves the security margin.
So a 128-bit key becomes like a 64-bit key.
Exactly. It provides only 64 bits of effective security against a quantum brute force attack. So to compensate for that and maintain long-term security, the required action is simply to double the key size. specifically upgrading from AES-128 to AES-256.
And doubling the key size provides exponential protection, restoring that security margin. Is that considered the final PQC solution for symmetric encryption?
For practical time horizons, you know, the 30 to 50 year range, yes. The quadratic speedup from Grover's is completely mitigated by the exponential protection of the larger key size. It effectively eliminates the vulnerability for the foreseeable future, making AES-256 the industry standard for quantum-safe symmetric encryption.
We've covered a massive amount of detail in this deep dive, from the strategic patience of the HNDL adversary all the way to the tactical pain points of the PQC bandwidth tax. Let's quickly recap the fundamental takeaways on this quantum ticking clock.
The evidence shows an undeniable convergence. You have the accelerated quantum timeline with CRQCs projected for 2028-2030. This means the HNDL threat is no longer theoretical. It's a present-day risk that's quantified by the data lifespan mismatch.
And it specifically impacts long-lived, high-value data in sectors like finance, where digital asset integrity is at stake, and healthcare, where the permanence of genomic data creates irreversible liability.
Exactly. And regulatory urgency is now a key driver. NSM 10's 2035 federal deadline, that projected $7.1 billion migration costs, and the EU's aggressive 2030 roadmap for high-risk systems.
It all underscores that this transition is mandatory, it's complex, and it is expensive.
So the actionable roadmap for executive leadership requires immediate budgeted action. It does. Launch the cryptographic inventory, prioritize your assets based on that critical exposure model, anything with a lifespan over 30 years, and immediately start piloting hybrid PQC schemes using the finalized NIST standards, MLChem and MLDSA.
And failure to prepare for the massive operational impacts of the PQC bandwidth tax on your networks, your middle boxes, your CM storage capacity will result in catastrophic costs and system failure.
That's the bottom line.
So what does this all mean for the executive who has to make critical resource decisions today? We've outlined the problem, the timeline, the cost, the solution, but the deeper implication here seems to be that we have to redefine confidentiality itself.
That is the essential shift. Confidentiality can no longer be viewed as a static cryptographic guarantee, a fixed lock that holds forever. It is now a time-bound function of your operational readiness and your cryptographic agility.
A function of readiness.
For any organization protecting long-lived data, the critical question is not whether the CRQC will succeed. It's how many years of harvested secret data you have already implicitly exposed by delaying your migration plan. So the only remaining question you have to answer for your board and your stakeholders is this. What is the current residual exposure window for your longest-lived asset? That number, that defines the depth of the breach you are currently building toward.